I think that that's important to understand, that you need to seek feedback, know when to take it, know when to pivot, and know when to adjust. And, you know, that's critical. I think it's also important to empower people to make decisions and to look at things creatively. I try to create an environment at Petrero where people can be fearless, but not reckless.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Muinato. I'm the director of the Roseman Institute at UCSF, the University of California, San Francisco. If you like what you hear today, please give us your review on iTunes. Our guest is Joe Urban, CEO of Petrero Medical. Petrero Medical is working to detect acute kidney injury, or AKI. AKI accounts for more than 300,000 deaths each year in American ICUs. But clinical reports show that if doctors could monitor urine output, they could detect AKI early on and reduce the risk of death. Joe successfully raised $27 million Series C round this past July. After getting 15-plus polite no's from investors, he thought it would be good to change how he pitched to the investors. He'll share with you what he did that made him successful in his fundraising effort. Joe started his career selling wine before making the transition to the medical device industry and had no intention to go back to the wine industry. He is ever committed to this industry as it makes huge impact to people's lives. Enjoy the talk. Welcome, Joe. Thanks for joining me today on a beautiful Friday afternoon, sunny outside. But anyway, congratulations on your recent fundraising success. You, Petrero, raised $27 million early this year. Is it this summer or early this year? Yeah.
This summer, June of 2018, we had our final close, and it was a lot of fun. We have some very supportive investors, and it's been a fantastic journey so far.
Yeah, that's great. So maybe before we dive into more detail on the fundraising aspect, can you tell us more about what Petrero Medical is and what problem you're trying to solve?
Sure. Petrero Medical was started by a guy named Dan Burnett, MD, and it was born out of the Theranova incubator. Theranova, I believe, has 13 portfolio companies now, and Dan is a serial entrepreneur, engineer by background, MD, had some time at the FDA and as a VC, so he understands all the different facets of making a device a reality. And 4 years ago, this started off with a clinical problem that's existed for over 100 years. The Foley catheter that's used in the ICU and OR settings around the world was largely not innovated. It was incrementally innovated over the last 100 years, but nothing that's significant. And urine output is a critical vital sign, and it's the least invasive way for a medical team to understand what's happening with the patient's kidneys in the form of urine production, whether it's a rapid production or a lower production, can show what's happening globally with the rest of the body. The reason that's important, every time the heart beats, 26% of the blood goes to the kidneys. And so an increase or decrease of urine production can very quickly show what's happening with the patient. In fact, it's a problem that has the last of the vital signs to be automated. And it's in this day and age, it would be like checking somebody's heart rate with a stethoscope every hour on the hour and expect to have great patient outcomes in the ICU and OR. It just doesn't, that would be malpractice. And so what Petrero has done is we've embedded sensors into a traditional urinary catheter. Those signals are picking up some very unique critical and vital signs. Intra-abdominal pressure, which today is invisible, a medical team could put together a tubing set, irrigate the bladder, increase it, and they could see what's happening internally But it's highly variable, very tedious, and the nurses absolutely hate it. And so what Dan and team created was a pressure sensor inside the Foley catheter that can register the pressures inside the abdomen with a push of a button, and more importantly, trend it over time. So if the pressures start to increase in the abdomen in a critically ill patient, and a medical team, a doctor and a nurse, and everybody's consulting on whether to take that patient to emergent procedures, to an emergent OR procedure to relieve some of that tension, right now it's somewhat of a guess, and usually it's too late. What we're doing is we're catching it early and showing them the trend of intra-abdominal pressure.
You were saying earlier that the nurse is doing it right now more like when they need to, or?
If a doctor asks, like in a trauma bay, by the way, this is only one of the parameters that we're picking up. We're also picking up core body temperature and urine output. And the urine output is where the greatest need is. Intra-abdominal pressure is neat because it doesn't exist today, where you could trend it over time. They put together a tubing set, spike a saline bag, irrigate the bladder, then they hold a manometer at the bladder level. If you have a thin patient, that you might be able to know where the bladder is. If you have an obese patient that's positioned in the ICU such that you don't know where the bladder is, three people could do the same reading and get three different tests or three different results. And so it's really intriguing. The doctors and nurses that have used it this year are super impressed with it. Urine output. So urine output as a vital sign. This is something that is interesting to me because I was at CR Bard for years, and we tried to solve this, and we couldn't. And it seems pretty simple. You have a Foley catheter. You're trying to make sure that the bladder is empty so you can see what the kidney is producing. And it's a deceptively difficult fluid dynamic problem that has yet to be solved until Petrero and Dan Burnett created the Acuren. And now we're able to measure with very precise measurements of what is happening with the kidney. Our next generation and what we're focused on right now is taking this information and applying it into a machine learning algorithm so we can predict the future status of a patient should the current status quo not change. And we're in our clinical evaluations and validation of that right now. Okay. It's very promising. We presented to the military back in August that with our algorithm, we were able to detect and predict acute kidney injury 3 hours before the gold standard, 97% accurate. That's fantastic. And why is that important? AKI, acute kidney injury, has five stages. Risk, your kidney's at risk of injury. Injury, failure, loss, and then end stage. When you get to failure, kidney failure, it's catastrophic. You have a 1 in 4 shot if you're in the ICU of dying. The number of patient deaths from renal failure a year is 300,000. Now, when you put that in perspective, and we throw around numbers, but these are 300,000 people with families, and they're no longer with us. That's more people than what lung cancer kills a year. But you don't know of AKI, right? You don't hear of it. Everybody knows lung cancer. It's, in fact, more than breast, colon, and prostate cancers combined. It is a silent killer that is just accepted because there has been no great pathway to address it. The cost to the U.S. healthcare system is $10 billion for AKI alone. So the problem we're going after is pretty sizable. And the hospitals that we've spoken with are very excited to at least address the shortcomings.
So you're now on clinical, and you mentioned that you are working with the military. Why your technology is important for the military?
The kidneys are the first to respond. There's a study that was done where a patient would give a liter of blood, and the first indication of anything, the urine output dropped immediately because the kidneys are so sensitive. They're the canary in the coal mine. So if you have we have a DOD grant right now to study with the pressure balloon, whether or not we can detect a hemorrhage. So a soldier is injured in the field, and they're exfilling that soldier out of the combat theater to a hospital that is in either in Germany or the U.S. They can monitor with precision what's happening in their abdomen. Right now, it's just impossible. The DoD is interested. We have an NIH grant to study in sepsis patients acute kidney injury. But we are a commercial stage company now, so we are selling to hospitals all over the United States. So it's not just the DoD. I referenced that because this was when we presented. The data was gathered over the last 2 years.
Okay, so you're commercial already.
We are. We're in hospitals. We're scaling the organization. We closed our fundraising round in June. We're moving to a new headquarters, 17,000 square feet. We have more demand than we have supply. And I have, as our board of directors calls them, champagne problems, but they're still problems. And so some of the challenges as a CEO I'm dealing with is how do we scale fast enough without burning too much cash as we cut in some of our cost-saving measures. Mm-hmm. And so that's the biggest driver for me right now.
Can we talk about your fundraising? That's the Series C. How big is the round?
$41 million in private placement, and we have $7 million in grants from the NIH and the DoD. So $48 million.
Wow, that's sizable. And the last round, many of the investment come from the Chinese investors.
We did. We had a group called GT Healthcare and Sonder Capital. And GT and Sonder led the round. And we had people realized how big of a problem this was globally and that we have a pretty clear shot at executing from our commercial plan. And so it was a neat experience for me as a first-time CEO to raise money. And it was very humbling. I did not realize how difficult that challenge is to raise money and to get the message across. And but it was a great learning experience, and I wouldn't trade it for the world.
What did you learn from that?
You know, when I first went in, I was 1 month in. We worked very hard in August to get the pitch deck, which is the presentation that you present to venture capitalists, and the presentation down. And I worked with my team and a creative agency to put together this presentation of what I thought they should know. And I was sure of myself. And I went in and I presented 15 times, and 15 times I had the same answer. And the venture community was very, very gracious and polite, and they would politely pass. And I think I learned that you need to seek feedback. And, you know, I was coming in as a first-time CEO, and I had no idea if what I was saying resonated. What I should have done is ask for their feedback. And when I realized that we needed to get a hold of the message and make sure that what I was meaning to say was being articulated correctly, I asked a favor of a friend and was put in touch with a guy named Rick Clow at Google Ventures. And he was a CEO at once, one time, and he agreed to meet with me for an hour to hear my pitch. And it was, I don't know if you're familiar with Google, but they have a very transparent, honest, raw, unfiltered feedback system with their OKRs and their objective key results. And it's what has made Google great. Something I had never experienced in person to that level, even being a military veteran. And I presented to Rick, and he was focused on the screen for probably 30 minutes as I went through my presentation. I tried to make eye contact with him. I tried to have conversations, and he was so focused, and he wouldn't do that. He just listened and looked at what I was presenting. When I finally made it to my last slide, and I concluded, he turned to me and he said, "Are you finished?" I said, "Yes. Go to slide one." And it was gut-punching feedback, but it's the feedback that I should have had, and I didn't. And so I credit Rick, and when something great happens with Potrero, I send him a note, and I thank him for the gift he gave us and gave me. It was that just honest, hard-hitting feedback.
What were the feedback that he gave you?
My message was meandering, that I was going in and out, and we need to focus. You know, I was trying to describe one thing and from a clinical standpoint, and I'm talking to a lay person in clinical. He knows a little bit, but he's not an MD. And everybody on Sand Hill, all the venture capitalists that I'd met with are either syndicates or their venture groups or family offices, investors. They, for the most part, were all lay people. And I was getting into, because I understood how big of a problem this is. I've traveled the world. I've seen it. I've seen the patients. I've seen how catastrophic it can be. But my message was all over the map. And it was so hard hitting, and it was 20 to 30 minutes of feedback that no one had ever given me. Mm-hmm. And I was working in an echo chamber where I would present to my team, I'm the new CEO, and they're saying, well, right. It sounds great, you know? And even, you know, like Dan Burnett's like, it sounds good, because I was so overconfident and I should have been over humble, especially in the first one. So what I learned is to actively listen, to seek the feedback, to present to those. Like I should have practiced with a handful of venture capitalists first. So what do you think? How can I make this better? And so I think those were the biggest learnings. I walked out of Google. I sat in the parking lot, and it was a pivotal point for me. I sat in the car, and I just stared at the steering wheel for a good 10, 15 minutes, processing what I had just heard. I took 5 pages of notes, and I realized that the overconfidence and I would say arrogance coming in, and I use that, and I'm saying it. It wasn't necessarily intentional, but I should have gone in with a greater humility, and that's the point where I stopped selling and started listening, and I tightened the message. I met with lots of venture capitalists, and I listened to what they were doing and what their goals were. And instead of keep driving into the point of what Potrero is doing, making sure there is alignment between that person, their firm, and Potrero, because this is such a mutual street, and we're taking money on the promise that we're going to return it times X, yeah. Right? And so for me, once I listened to that and I heard it as a young first-time CEO, that was so critical. And I know it was a day that I'll always remember, and I'm forever grateful to Rick Clough at Google for spending that time with me.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. When you met with the ventures, oftentimes ventures like, here, I'd like to hear your story. And what you're saying is understanding where they come from, what their needs are. How do you navigate the conversation that so that they talk more about what their needs are rather than you telling them about your project?
Yeah. So what I started doing is I would research and understand who my target audience was if I was going to go present to them. And it was such a whirlwind when I first started. You have so many things happening and you're learning so fast. So when I first came in, we were going from a science project to locking in V&V and getting ready for commercialization. And so I had a lot of activities. And after that moment with Rick, when I would schedule a meeting, I would research on LinkedIn, understand who I'm sitting down with, have conversations with people that may know them. And then when I would come in, just ask some baseline questions, you know, what is important to you in your firm? You know, what type of investment? What are you looking for in a portfolio company? Tell me about some of the successful portfolio companies. And when I came in, I just said, look, I'm I'm figuring this out because I'm a first-time CEO. And I thought that that would make it a bad thing to say. But people would open up, and that's the ethos of Silicon Valley, that everyone's been there. They know how hard it is to be here. And, you know, it's a great place to be, but it is hard. And when I would ask about their fund and the targets for their fund, where they are, like, and what they're looking to do. And so what I found was that some people want to stay in the loop. Look, I just want to know so I can keep tabs. And or we're usually a earlier seed or A, you're raising your C. Or C is a little too early for us. We want commercial stage companies. Okay, why don't I provide just an update and then I'll put you on our quarterly newsletter. And then it was for me an opportunity to understand what was happening, and for me it was a great opportunity to keep refining the presentation and our pitch. And afterwards, of course, I'd say, okay, I know this is you're a later stage company. What do you think? Does this make sense? Am I articulating it? So when I go to somebody that is a Series C investor, did I articulate it correctly? And I just kept tightening it and tightening it and tightening it. So I think those are the jewels that at least they're jewels to me because it was such a humbling and wonderful experience.
My second question, because I mentioned that was good feedback for a lot of people to hear, I think. Rick Claw, you said, so do you know him personally? Because sometimes when you come in,
I was introduced to Rick and sent him an email. He scheduled an hour, and you can only imagine Google's hearing every pitch in the world, and to give me an hour of his time was worth more than any gold that you could ever get. And it's not just that it was an hour of his time, because I could tell you he didn't check his watch or his phone once. He was intensely focused on the TV where it was being projected, would not look at me, and the feedback was rapid fire and hard and raw.
So did you go back to the 15 VC that you went the first time and come back with another?
No, approach? You know, it was... I realized that with them, I probably set the wrong tone, and my message was too meandering. And to go back and say, "This is what we're doing now," my preference is to just keep them informed. And I asked for permission. I did go back to them and ask, "Can I keep you informed of our progress?" And so, you know, it's one of those things where, as we progress and go through this, I'll keep them informed, and if it's the right time for them, then if we do a Series D, then so be it. Mm-hmm. But they were very polite and gracious to me, and you know, for that I'm thankful.
Yeah. So you keep mentioning about your message was meandering, and then you, at some point you mentioned about how you deliver the messages to medically approached rather than more layman terms.
It would be very clinical, and then other points it would be very commercial, and you know, and it wasn't, you know, I look at the presentation now and what do I want to communicate to them? What's the most important thing that I need, whether it's a doctor now that's buying the product or an investor or a potential employee, what do I want to communicate? And before I was telling a story that just wound through the hills and people pay attention, but it was not compelling. And just tightening that and understanding that each slide, it was driving to the point. And so the presentation went from like 30 minutes to 6. And it was, this is what we're working on at Petrero. This is how we're driving it. 6 to 10, somewhere in there. Because we tightened up our message. And people don't want to sit there and listen for 30 minutes to a PowerPoint presentation. I don't want to. I know they don't. You know, and so I tightened it. I used more visuals, and then I would just drive home the point and not waste their time.
And then you can use the remainder of the time for discussion.
100%. And questions. And then if there's, hey, can you tell me more about the in-depth clinical aspect? Yes. So then I could pull up a presentation that was geared towards that. But get through the first 10 minutes and just focus on what you're doing. Why are we here? You know, maybe there are organizations that can pitch for 10 minutes and they write a check, but this is just the permission to go another 5 minutes. And so I wanted to be very respectful of their time and present the information that over time we learned was mutually interesting.
So if you have to give advice to somebody who's going to pitch and try to tighten it, the slide to the 10 minutes or 5 to 10 minutes, what need to be included in that?
Yeah.
Slide.
I think our pitch deck went down to probably 10 slides. Well, with the intro, maybe the most it was, because sometimes we would tailor it, was 15 at the most. And when we first started, it was 30 to 35 slides. And having the 10 slides, it's important. You need to, and we didn't even show the product until like the 10th slide. So they're sitting there going, what am I here for? This is frustrating. They're very busy, right? So right off the bat, new slide was, the title slide had the product and this, and I would introduce the company and Potrero and our mission. Then I would, so they'd see it right off the bat. And the next slide was the clinical problem, why this is important, the cost to the U.S. healthcare system, the current status quo of why this technology is better. For example, like with the Foley catheter, it vapor locks and creates a barrier to where the bladder can't empty. If you're pushing fluids based on what you see in the urine drainage bag, you're hurting patients, you're overloading them, and it spirals the kidney. Our technology clears that line every 1 to 2 minutes. And articulating that, but not spending a lot of time on the technical or the deep clinical, but just sharing with the audience why that was important. And then going on to how we're going to execute our commercial plan. And back then it was, we're heading into commercialization. Now I can say, we said this, and this is what we did. And everything we've said, we're doing. And so that's been a really gratifying thing. And then financials. So venture capitalists and investors are interested in helping the world, but they're also a business that is their purpose is to make money. And that is, it has to be clearly articulated. They have LPs that they answer to, limited partners, that have given them money to invest. And so how am I going to make money for my customers, the LPs? And so articulating that and the pathway was critical.
Well, that's good. I think that would be very helpful for a lot of people.
I hope so, because I look at it in a different way now. When I first started, 20 years of sales and marketing experience, I thought, let's get this over with so I could build the company, or we can build the company. And now if I could help someone else or another CEO, because it's not easy, just even if it's one thing I say, if it can help that one person, like Rick helped me that day, I feel, and this is probably what's created this fabric and ethos here in Silicon Valley, where you're always wanting to pay it forward. I feel like I owe it to others to do what Rick did for me.
That's good. That's what the Roosevelt Institute saw in that.
Great.
They tap in a lot of people like you who are willing to give back and coach and mentor the young entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Sam. So, okay, well, the other things that we hear a lot about, like, being where I am, I've seen a lot of people come saying like, oh, you know, we are approached by rich Chinese investors.
Yeah.
And oftentimes people don't know how to work with them. Obviously, you've been very successful in getting funding from the Chinese investor? And can you tell us how you navigate that and how you make sure you work with the right investors?
It's the I was introduced to this group by another investor, that GT Healthcare, and we had conversations with them. Our goals were aligned. They had LPs that were, they're based in Hong Kong, and they are very, very sharp business leaders. And so when they came in, they did a full diligence. They toured our facility multiple times. They interviewed me. We worked side by side. And, you know, it was really interesting. And so I was fortunate to be introduced to the right investors. And I wouldn't say there's the wrong investors, but we were aligned. And so I can't speak for the other Chinese investors, but I think it's just like here in the U.S. You probably have great investors and then not so great. I think it's everywhere. And so we were fortunate to find a series of very good investors for our round. And we were, at one point, we had, of the $27 million after everything was factored in, what was left after the pro rata, we had 10 times that amount trying to push in. And anytime you have that situation, that's the best situation to be in. So we were very, very blessed and fortunate. And it, once it happened, it was fast.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So now what's next? Now you get the 27 million.
Yeah, I feel like
that's where the work began.
That's right. The, you know, it's one of those things where you expect to feel wonderful when you raise your, like I thought when I first started, raise a 27 and it's awesome. It is a great feeling. But now the weight that I was carrying on my shoulders is just different. It's instead of having to raise the money to keep the company going, now it's, I have to build the company and keep driving forward tremendous shareholder value. And so we are in the process of moving to a new HQ in Hayward. And our HQ will be 17,000 square feet. We have a clean room. We have IQC. And we have a giant warehouse because we're building a ton of these devices. And we have the R&D team's very excited because their space is so big. And same thing with the other organization departments. And so that's like top of mind right now, the move. We're doing a tremendous amount of work on driving the cost out of the product and validating that everything is operational. And so, because if you cut in a new product or part, you have to make sure that it's doesn't affect the quality of the product. And we are doing that with tremendous diligence. And that is that's wonderful. And then I'm focused on reducing labor rates and the other things. And I know that as we squeeze out the manufacturing inefficiencies and we focus on scaling the organization and we drive down our bill of material costs, it's a highly profitable company and it provides those investors that value. While I'm doing these activities, we've segmented and separated the engineers into two groups. A group that's focused on R&D, so research and development. They're testing all the materials. They're making sure that the device is still functioning as we look at cost savings projects. And the research and innovation group. And these are the teammates that are focused on stuff that will be to market 12 to 36 months from now. So that to me is fun. So we continue to scope up and drive value beyond what we have right now. And that to me is really neat. And I think for the team, it's wonderful. And so, and then the global expansion, we're in talks with a Japanese multinational strategic to distribute our product in Japan. We have conversations in China, South America and Europe, and then Africa with South Africa. And so literally it's a lot of things happening at once and making sure that we keep our regulatory pathway going with our predictive algorithms to make sure that we have our label by the end of 2019.
That's great. Yeah. Your experience, you have a lot of sales experience.
Yeah.
And I learned that you were at one point selling wine before you come to the device world.
That's right.
Can you? How do you make that transition? Yeah.
It's interesting. I was going to be a lawyer in college. I went to Colorado State University. I was the student body president at CSU. And the way I found the gallows, as the student body president, our big rival is the University of Colorado. And we had a bet that year. A loser had to have the winner shave a mohawk into their head. And this is back when I had lots of hair and, you know, it's, and we lost, we got creamed that year. It was bad. So he came onto our campus, the TV cameras were there, and he literally shaved to the skin a mohawk into my head. And it wasn't just a mohawk, and I had to have it for a month. That was a deal. So I couldn't just like immediately just shave the head. He didn't do it even, so it was slightly offset. So I looked ridiculous. I'm the student body president with a mohawk. And I was a political science major, so I was about to go to law school, either CU or DU. Those were the two that I was looking at. And then my brother came in, who was he was a freshman, I was a senior, and into my office, and he said, "Hey, the career fair is happening. Let's go mess with them." And so we walked upstairs. And I was walking from booth to booth. I'm in shorts and a t-shirt with a crooked mohawk. And I'm saying, "Hey, look, you hired?" You know, and they're looking at me and they can't get me away fast enough. And my brother's dying. He thinks it's hilarious because I'm going to all these employers and they're being, you know, they were looking beyond me. You know, it was fun. Silly college stuff, right?
That's the fun stuff that you remember.
Yeah. And then when I got to the gallow table, they were very gracious. They're like, "What's up with the mohawk?"
He's like a fun guy.
Yeah. And they were just chatting with me. And somebody walked by because I was asking about the wine and, you know, just, and they were being very gracious. Somebody walked by and slapped me on the back and said, "Hey, Prez," and walked off. And they said, "What was that?" And I explained that I was a student body president. And the next day they were in my office, the national recruiter, and he's like, "Listen, we found your resume," because back then you had resume books, and the student, I fit their profiles, student body president, fraternity leader, and Army ROTC. And so the student leader, they started having conversations with me about coming into their national recruiting class. They recruit three, and I went through like with hundreds and made it to the final three. Then the competitive side kicked in and I wanted it. And the more I looked at this, the more I realized I would be miserable as an attorney. And thank goodness that my brother came in. Otherwise, I'd be an attorney. And it's not, I have lots of relatives that are attorneys, but for me, I know me, and it would not have been a happy, I would have made it happy, but I know what I'm doing now is very purpose and mission driven. And so I ended up at the Gallo Winery in the sales and marketing team. 5 years progressed through the leadership. And then I got a call from Boston Scientific.
Nothing random.
Not necessarily. Okay. 25% of Boston Scientific's sales organization comes from consumer packaged goods. And the majority of that 25% come from Gallo.
They must have really good training.
They have incredible training. So it was Procter & Gamble, Pepsi, Xerox, and Xerox isn't consumer package, but Xerox and Gallo was the bulk majority of the people. Because if you have to fight for an inch of shelf space, you're going to go into the OR and fight for your business every single day. And so it was a tremendous training. And then it was the people that Gallo had screened to get to that point. It was a winning model for Boston. And it was a fast way to get very well-trained salespeople that they could transfer clinical knowledge to. And so when I went to Boston Scientific, the clinical training was intense. And we spent months, and then just for the initial training, and then twice a year we'd go to Boston and make sure that our training on the product, the technical aspects, and the clinical aspects were completely up to date. That's how I ended up in MedDevice 20 years ago.
And you stay.
I loved it.
No going back to the wine industry.
No, I'm a customer now. Yeah, I'm a customer, but that's it. I still buy Gallo wine. Gina Gallo is a tremendous leader. She took over the business, and she's just a fantastic leader. So I think the Gallos have grown their business, and I wish them the best of success. It's a great company, wonderful culture, and they just they treat their people very well.
Well, that's good. Yeah. That's also a learning lesson for everybody.
That's right.
To treat their people well. This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. You've shared some of your advice earlier, but if you have to give three advice to early entrepreneurs, what are they?
Yeah, that don't fall in love with your idea. And I did that. I thought that our presentation was white hot and it was a dud. You know, just our message was off. But also, I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs fall in love with their idea. Engineers fall in love with their project, and you know, I think that's important to understand that you need to seek feedback, know when to take it, know when to pivot, and know when to adjust, and you know, that's critical. I think it's also important to empower people to make decisions and to look at things creatively. I try to create an environment at Petrero where people can be fearless, but not reckless. Fearless in the sense that they can try things and not worry about getting fired. And I say that with, you know, like some companies, there's a concern that I don't want to stick my neck out because I'll get thumped, you know, and I've lived that, I've seen it, and I just don't want it at Petrero. So I encourage the team to try things, to run things in parallel, and to ask for feedback. The people, the Petrero is, I'm just one of the people at Petrero. I don't have an office. I sit with the team. We have 50 people. And I believe that, everybody should, everybody has a role, and that's how I look at it. And every single person's important to the organization. And, I take out the trash because I believe that if I ask somebody else to do it, I better be willing to do it myself. And so treating people right. We have our team meeting is at 1 today, and I always like to kick it off and take a moment and just let everyone have a little fun. I give two puns. Today is, one of them is, how do you put a baby alien to sleep? Do you know?
No, I don't know.
You rock it.
You rock it.
And so, but it's a chance just to kind of get people to unwind a little bit. And I'd ask every employee 5 questions, and then unique to them, they're fun. And then they ask me the exact same questions. We scramble them, and every week I present like 4, and the entire company has to guess who it is. But it allows me to get to know people and them to get to know me. And it's amazing what you find out. And people you wouldn't expect,
yeah.
Like our lead data scientist, I found out that he loves speed metal, and you would never guess it seeing him. So he has his earphones on, and he's listening to speed metal, and so it's like, great. But it comes down to people and culture, and a happy environment will create long-term success, I'm convinced of that. So that was kind of a rambling, meandering story.
No, I think that's
those
great.
Are the... It's the people, it's fearless, not reckless, and I would just say that don't fall in love with an idea.
Mm-hmm. So I always ask people, like, what's your, you know, what books you're reading, and is there any book that you can recommend for me to read another?
So I'm dyslexic, and so are my 2 kids. And so for me, I do read books, but what I've found that has been a complete life changer is Audible. and I listen to Audible books at 2 speed. Just, it's the way I process. And so for me, in the last year, I've listened to 70 books. Some of my favorites are Happiness Advantage, and that's about how to drive an amazing culture. It's about how people are wired. And that's, I think, just a fantastic book. I look at some other books like Extreme Ownership is a great book written by 2 former Navy SEALs and relating their experience in Iraq to relating it to business and how to approach problems. But it's also, I bought 10 and I asked the entire company to read them and pass them when they're done. And they do. And there are certain things, like we had a business emergency happen and I remembered a part of the chapter. And so I flipped to it and I said, send an email, read page 238. And so you're right. This is how we're going to do it. And that extreme ownership and that mindset. The Power of Positive Thinking and the words and visualization and the critical nature of that is a wonderful book and reminder of how to do it. And then I also bought the team the book Endurance. And Endurance is the book of Ernest Shackleton, who was going to cross Antarctica in the early 1900s. And it's a story about he put up an ad in the UK, in London, that said 50 men wanted, incredibly dangerous, many dark nights, chance of return near zero, pay terrible, right? And he did this, and he said, glory guaranteed, glory upon success guaranteed, 50 spots, and he had 2,000 people show up. And he went through and he picked people that were positive in nature, because to be in those extreme conditions, you have to have a positive mindset, an optimistic mindset. And it proved to be very important because the ship was locked in ice and crushed. But he brought everyone back. Not to ruin the book, but it's a well-known historical figure. But it was important because there's a lot of commonalities between Ernest Shackleton and the Endurance, and a startup like Potrero. It's dark. You don't know what's going to happen. The wages are lower than other places. Excitement is guaranteed. You know, fame and glory, should we be successful? Absolute. And, you know, it was kind of fun, but the team really enjoyed reading it. So those are some of the top picks out of the 68, 70 books in the last year.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
It's been really fun to get to
learn. Likewise.
I learned a lot from you today.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun.